I'm Aaron Brown in Minnesota.
And I'm Carl Jacob in New York City. And this is Power in the Wilderness.
Refuse to lay, blame the mayor. If you cannot draw your pay, blame the mayor. If your false teeth break in two and your food you cannot chew, what's a man to do? Blame the mayor.
You know, Aaron, I've been struggling for a long time to figure out where we can get that poem into the show called Blame the Mayor.
And you succeeded.
Oh, thank you.
At long last. Yeah.
I figured we should ride the wave of the sea shanty movement that's so popular right now.
I don't know if that's still popular, but we're going to get a resurgence, I think, after that performance.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
I don't know that when Victor Power sang those words in his own voice, it was a sea shanty, but it works as a sea shanty.
It does work as a sea shanty. And Victor did sing them in his voice. In his office, shortly after taking control of the city, and I just think it's a great example of the fact that, in addition to a lot of people supporting him, there are also still people out there that don't support him and are finding reasons to blame everything on Vic.
Well, it's the plight of a mayor, as much as any elected position in our government. The mayor of a town is so often personified with all of the town's ills, and that was certainly the case for Vic Power. His people loved him, but there was a lot going on in Hibbing, and, you know, he was expected to fix a lot of problems.
So in 1913, Vic did fix a lot of problems. His team got the ball rolling on the massive number of improvements that they were doing and secured the funding for all of it with little friction, but ultimately they were successful. And Vic is up for re-election at the start of 1914 and is easily re-elected. No one ran against him.
Yeah, it was unopposed. So that's a very rare thing in Hibbing politics at that time. So it shows you how much he had swamped the opposition by his record in 1913. He had really done a lot.
I think Oliver just didn't have the time to really organize an opposition and probably felt like it was futile. Plus, remember, they've got the Lake Superior Taxpayers Association, which, you know, is their war machine essentially revving up to get into full swing. So I think their priorities were probably elsewhere that year.
They're lining up on a different battlefront to be determined.
So the last episode covered through 1913, and the theme of this episode, or at least for the year of 1914, is controlled chaos. I mean, imagine, you know, the streets are getting ripped up. There are sewers getting installed. The electricity is getting redone. They're installing lights everywhere. You know, and Vic's meeting resistance in every direction that he turns trying to get this stuff done. But, you know, he's swiftly plowing through it against all presumable odds.
And he's also maintaining a very vigorous law practice while serving as mayor of Hibbing. That's one of the remarkable things about Vic Power, is that he's the number one lawyer making arguments in the municipal and district court. And so his work ethic is unbelievable. He's working nonstop, well into every night, either for the village or for his clients.
It's crazy, the sheer number of cases.
It reminds me of an old sitcom trope where, you know, he has to duck from courtroom to courtroom to try to keep up with cases on entirely different cases, and you wonder if he ever got mixed up and made the wrong argument in the wrong courtroom. But he does have a growing law firm, a lot of clerks and partners helping him, but he's intimately involved in a lot of court cases.
The dude is just, I wonder how much sleep he got. Because there's tons of reports of him just being in his office well after 9 or 10 p.m.
Yeah, it's the second floor of a brick building on Pine Street, and the lights would be on well into the night after everyone else had gone home because he was working.
So the big bet that Vic and William Ryder put on advertising Hibbing's prosperity is paying off. You know, news of this prosperity is spreading like wildfire across Minnesota and beyond. And it's attracting people. Hundreds and hundreds of new citizens are coming into Hibbing and the population is exploding. You know, and they're coming to look for work and to have this better life that everyone keeps talking about, and probably just to be part of the energy and the excitement that is Vic Power's government, which clearly is something to behold.
It doesn't hurt that the mining companies are desperate for labor at this point. They desperately need people and they can't keep them. Of course, they're trying to pay them very little, which is part of the problem. But they need people badly. And the reason is because of an increased demand for iron ore and steel. And we know that 1914 might explain why that is.
With the turn of the 20th century, cameras begin their turning in Berlin. One of the earliest motion pictures finds Prince von Bismarck exhorting the Germans to love blood and iron.
Overseas in Europe, World War I has started. And if you know World War I, you know it's a complicated story. The Archduke gets shot, and it creates a chain of events that leads to most of the great powers of Europe lining up on either side of a major war. And the United States was not a part of this war at first, but the enormous war machines being built in Europe drives up the price of steel and the demand for steel. And so U.S. Steel over in North America is, you know, maybe not involved in the war, but they're happily filling orders for steel needed in Europe. And of course, it makes American steel scarce. And so they need to make more of it, and very quickly. And this is creating all kinds of ripple effects down to Hibbing, Minnesota, even the small town in northern Minnesota, where half the population was born in one of those European countries. And the war is not just a distant foreign press story in the newspaper, but something involving their loved ones, their families, their hometowns, and in many cases, them. They themselves know that they might get called back to their home country.
It's kind of unique for America at this time, because I don't know of any other place in America that had such a concentrated number of human beings that were from these countries that started the war.
Yeah. Well, you could compare Hibbing to New York City, which is a very diverse city then as it is now. But if you look at this period, Hibbing is as diverse as New York City in terms of foreign birth. And it's concentrated in a very small town, very intimate small town, surrounded on all sides by a mine, which means that when you have great powers facing off in Europe, members of those powers are neighbors. They're working in the same mine. They might be on the same crew. They might be the guy that you go down to the mine with, you know, who holds the equipment while you swing the hammer. And so it's a very unique, unusual circumstance. And you have miners drilling in the streets, knowing that they might get drafted into, say, the Austrian army.
Drilling as in marching, not with like drills in the ground.
That's right. Military drills. The marching. Yeah.
It was the Austrians, right? There's like an article about Austrians doing military drills in the streets.
Austrians, and another about Italians. And those two groups are on the opposite side of the war. And people with British heritage, some of them are going to Canada to enlist with the Royal Air Force. A number of Hibbing boys become pilots and fly for the British. Of course, Vic Power's personal secretary, S.V. Saxby, is a British national whose three brothers all enlist to fight with the British Army in World War I.
And one of the really interesting things, Aaron, that you told me about this period is that news is so hard to come by in these countries that are at war. And the news is so good in Hibbing. You know, the front pages of the Hibbing Tribune and the OR are largely about the war. So people from Hibbing are clipping the articles or writing home about the articles to relay information to their family who's in the middle of the war.
That's right. Because the U.S. wasn't in the war, we weren't censoring our news about it. So troop movements, military engagements, things that would be kept out of the papers in Italy or Croatia or Germany, they were getting into our papers. And so because so many of those people were in Hibbing, they were relaying that information back. And it's really remarkable how both sides of the war are represented in Hibbing. Because Hibbing is a, Frank Hibbing, the namesake of the town, was a German. There's a lot of Germans in Hibbing. And there's a lot of what they called Austrians, which were actually more like what we would later call Yugoslavians or the Slavic people of the coast of Dalmatian, things like that. And so the Austrians and the Germans were next to the Irish and the British on different sides of the war. The U.S. didn't have a side yet. So you have in this village this palpable sense of neutrality. The village isn't taking a side because so many different interests are in the village. Mm. But what's happening is the demand for steel is revving up the town. So it's a kind of a war fever that's in the town, even though the town isn't fighting the war. It's supplying steel for the war.
It's fascinating to me that the small woodland town of Hibbing, Minnesota, would be one of the places in the U.S. that is feeling World War I more than anyone else in the country before America's even involved. Because it is so remote. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be the place that is pumping out all of this stuff that they need for the war, which is steel.
It really becomes a, very quickly a prosperous time, certainly for the mines, not as much for the workers, which is actually what plays into how the next couple of years are going to go.
So remember that massive tax levy that was set for 1914? Well, the Oliver and its allies at the Taxpayers Association pay it. I'm assuming begrudgingly, but it does get paid, which it's clear with this action that they are probably biding time, however. Because for the following year of 1915, the tax levy does not get raised. Vic and his team lower it by $1 million. And to me, that seems like a strategic show to the mines by power that they don't need to worry about it going up anymore. And I thought that was good faith by power so that the mines wouldn't take it as a sign of aggression. But I'm not sure it was enough.
No, he was still. The issue was who says so. And Vic declared the previous year that the village gets to set its tax rate and we tax what we feel is appropriate. The fact that Vic eased off just a little in the following year was still his choice, and he was doing so partly for political reasons. He wanted to demonstrate that he wasn't just randomly and arbitrarily taxing the mines. He wanted to show that he was only taxing for what the village needed to make the improvements that they promised. And they had done quite a bit and felt that they could afford it after the previous levy to ease up a little bit. But for the mines, it was still an independent Hibbing building at its discretion. And they also knew that what Vic had planned, what he was announcing, was going to cost money down the line, and they still didn't like what he was about to do.
Yeah. And in 1914, there's also a lot of emphasis put on this so-called White Way, which is the main street of Hibbing, Pine Street, getting rewired and lit with super bright electric lights. Something we now accept as commonplace, but at the time it was radical, and it was a huge expense to install them. And they're just putting so much light out on the street that it starts getting national attention. And in our research, we found a postcard that was published in New York City that has a photograph, because it was so crazy to see this town in the middle of the wilderness. It's remarkable. On the postcard, you can see these really bright lights lighting up the street and the buildings. And then if you look above the lights, you can also see the stars as brightly in the sky as you would if there was no light or no light pollution.
That's probably the image that best conjures what I think of Hibbing at this time, which is it's this city, this growing, vibrant, almost cosmopolitan city in the middle of a dark, big forest. But Hibbing had cut this spot in the woods and made a city.
What's cool about it is that it's later noted by Powers administration that it is actually saving the city loads of money in the following years because the cost of operating the lights goes down so much from the gas ones. But it's also something that the naysayers could point to show unnecessary spending in the moment because it was so expensive to initially install.
The lights that Victor Powers' administration built become this symbol of his administration. They're interesting. It's a steel pole with a big bulb at the top and then four other bulbs almost as big as the main bulb. So there's actually five lights on every pole. And that's what makes people think that he's extravagant. But it's also producing a tremendous amount of light and it's beautiful. It's a very attractive light setup. And that actually becomes, to both his supporters and his detractors, a symbol of sorts.
So that kind of sums up 1914. I mean, there was a lot happening, but not really a lot of new stuff happening. We kind of remark about it as a nothing year. It wasn't a nothing year. It was an everything year, but there was nothing new happening in 1914.
I wonder what it would have been like to live through it, because we look back on it, and this is true of a lot of years in history, but so much was about to happen that you have to imagine there's a lot of stress and tension, excitement, change in the air. But the big events are going to start hitting, at least in Hibbing, in 1915. That's when this brewing battle between the mines and the village is about to take off.
1914 certainly is the calm before the storm. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. When we look back at Victor Powers' life, the year 1915 is peak Vic.
That's right.
This is the climax of Vic's career, and arguably the year that probably drove him into the ground. 1915, I think, was Vic's 8 years.
Yeah.
Based on everything that he did and was getting done to him.
You know, I think it could be safely said that the reason we're talking about Vic Power in our time is because of what Vic Power did in 1915.
Yes. This is the year. This is the episode you've been waiting for in terms of the meat. Because this year is crazy. It's totally crazy. First of all, Vic wins again. This time the mines did run someone against him, but Vic creamed them again.
The whole council was swept into office against opposition. The mines cobbled together a ticket, but it was exploded.
And people are starting to talk about Vic running for governor after this because his profile is getting so huge. He's getting so popular, not only in Hibbing, but the word is spreading across the state and even outside of the state and in a lot of respects all the way back to New York City because that's where the big mucky mucks for U.S. Steel are. And clearly they took note of Vic's coup in 1913. So this is a very celebratory year or begins as a very celebratory year for Vic. But remember the Taxpayers Association wanting to attack Vic using state laws? Well, they found someone to sponsor that bill that they had started writing in 1913 by the name of Harrison. And Harrison is about to bring this bill to the floor of the legislature in the state of Minnesota in St. Paul in the year 1915. And what the contents of this bill are effectively would stop Vic from being able to raise the tax levy anymore and would effectively force him to push it back down to where it was. And this would be a statewide law. So it would take the power from the mayors to effectively run their own cities and have economic control of their own cities.
It's called the Harrison Per Capita Bill. And the way that it's constructed is it caps the amount of tax that a village can make based on the number of people in the village. See, Vic never set the tax rates very high at all. It was in the middle of the pack in terms of the percentage tax rate. But because the mines had so much valuable ore in their property, they paid an enormous amount of money when they paid their taxes. So the per capita tax bill was going to cap it. And the only village in the whole state that would have been affected by the bill is Hibbing, Minnesota. because it's a very large geographical village in a place where there's a very valuable iron ore mine in the city, in the village limits. So it's targeted at Hibbing, and it's presented as, oh, it's only fair per capita, people shouldn't have enormous amounts of taxes if there's not that many people there, but it was specifically targeted at Hibbing.
So it was covertly sort of slipped into the legislature, but much like the Oliver having Pinkerton spies, Vic also had, I guess we could call them spies, he was able to determine what was going on and got ahead of them a little bit with the Harrison Bill in what I think is probably one of the more or the most remarkable things that Vic ever did in his entire career. He decides that he's going to beat the Lake Superior Tax Association at their own game. And he takes 100 men with him down to St. Paul, and they take over a hotel that's right next to the legislature and put together what, in Vic's words, he calls a war room to start a counter-lobbying effort against the Harrison Bill. Can you imagine that happening today?
It's the size of it and the sophistication of it that is most remarkable. Imagine the St. Paul Hotel. It's a beautiful, newer hotel at the time, and it's the one of the first hotels that caters to the motorist. So it's got a turnaround out front, so the people in their big old Pierce Arrow limousine cars would pull up, and a valet would park their car for them, and they'd walk in, and there'd be the desk and then the bar right in the front lobby. You just took a long drive from Hibbing or Duluth, and now you're coming into this beautiful hotel, and you go up to the suite, the Hibbing suite, where for weeks the men of Hibbing, led by Vic Power, have been camped. And it's smoky, and there's tumblers of whiskey and gin, you know, waiting for you when you get up there. And it's just a thrum of activity as they're marking, probably on some kind of board, the votes and the people that they've talked to. You've got Vic Power, but you've got men like S.V. Saxby or Doug McEachin, you know, J.P. Murphy are there kind of compiling the information, and Vic is kind of calling out orders like a Patton, like a general. You know, he's in the middle of this activity. And what they do is they match, man for man, the U.S. Steel lobbying operation, which was thought impossible. That was the point of the Lake Superior Tax Association. Put some money together, hire some lawyers out of Duluth, put them down in the Capitol, and have them sit on the lawmakers so that they vote the right way. Well, what if there was a U.S. Steel lobbyist, but then in came a guy from Hibbing? A lawyer, a businessman, a merchant, not just some, you know, nobody, but a guy who owned something and was a real professional that lawmaker would have had to have listened to and respect. And they're there to counter with information prepared by Vic Power and his team, information put out by the Steel Corporation, to argue for Hibbing, to talk about what it was like before when the mines ran the show versus now when the people ran the show. And it was a remarkable solution. And then they'd report back to the headquarters. And this is where Victor Power really demonstrates his ability, not only as a lawyer, but as a politician. When there was a close vote or a rep or a senator who was on the fence, they'd get the particulars on that person, and that merchant from town would bring it back to the St. Paul, and then they'd send in Vic. He was the closer. And when Vic came to the Capitol, he spent not as much time as you'd think at the Capitol. He spent most of his time at the St. Paul Hotel planning things.
And smoking cigars.
And keep in mind, the village council has R.L. Geiselman on the council. He makes cigars for a living. So there's plenty of cigars. He's got a cigar factory. So that's why I'm confident there was smoke. But Vic comes in as the closer into an office of a senator or a representative, or sometimes into the committee rooms themselves. And there are stories where these committee meetings are happening and the lawmakers are debating the bill, and the door swings open in the back and Vic comes into the room, and it's enough to distract the debate and stop people from talking because it's such an event that Vic comes in. He's built such a reputation as a giant killer. His reputation literally precedes him. And he's very charismatic and a brilliant orator. We know this from his law history. So when he comes into a room, he's not just there to make the sale, but he's playing the part of the giant killer. And it's a combination of marketing and political savvy and then just good old-fashioned rhetoric.
And timing.
Yeah, and timing. And when he gets into a room, he can come in, wow people, shake up a committee, and basically change the votes. You know, a committee vote that would have gone to the Steel Corporation might be disrupted on that day, and it might go the other way, and that bill might get stuck. And that's how he did it.
It just reminds me of when I first started producing movies, an older, wiser producer said to me, a good producer knows when to not be on set and when to come on set to make everyone understand that they need to shape up.
Yeah, that's what this was. He doesn't live in the hallways of the Capitol. He lives at the hotel, but he comes when it's time.
And the thing about this that's so remarkable is he got the committee to drop the Harrison bill completely, and it never came to the floor for a vote.
Yeah.
They didn't even have to vote against it because the operation persuaded them to just not touch it. They're like, screw it, we're not gonna touch this one.
Yeah. It scared them because it put them in the position of, instead of just quietly voting for the corporation position, which was the normal way of doing things in St. Paul and still is, they made it uncomfortable for lawmakers who didn't know much about mining or Hibbing or anything, made it uncomfortable for them to vote for the bill. And so it's smothered in committee. And it's actually one of the biggest legislative accomplishments by a small town in their state capital to that moment.
News of the Harrison bill getting thrown out gets to Hibbing before Vic and his team returns. And in the same way people lost their minds in the first election win of Vic, imagine that times, let's say times two to be conservative.
Yeah.
Because the last one was pretty huge. And when Vic steps off the train, almost everybody in Hibbing is there to greet him, not only just to greet him, but the band is there playing music. They have torches.
Yeah.
His friend Carl Thiel brings all of his new fancy, what they describe as Varicolor lights. So there's these colored lights shining on Vic, and he gets off of the train and people lose their minds and are cheering and drinking and celebrating that the town that elected this guy just walloped the Steel Corporation at their own game in St. Paul. Published in the paper with a very handsome profile photo of Vic looking off to the right with a determined stare in his eyes.
Yes.
With the headline, Mayor Victor L. Power given royal reception. The biggest demonstration that has ever been given in Hibbing occurred on Thursday night when the citizens of the city turned out en masse to greet Mayor Victor L. Power on his return from St. Paul, where he has spent the past 3 weeks fighting the Harrison per capita tax bill. Every available automobile and thousands of people, headed by the Hibbing Concert Band, were at the Duluth, Mesabi, and Northern Depot when the 11 o'clock train arrived and gave Mr. Power one of the most rousing receptions that has ever been given anyone in Hibbing or on the Iron Range. A line of march was formed at the depot, headed by the band, which marched up 3rd Avenue to Pine Street, thence to the Armory, where a large crowd had gathered to greet Mr. Power, and when he arrived, a cheer went out that would have done credit to an Indian tribe. It was Hibbing's lone fight against the most powerful interests in the state, Duluth, and some portions of the Mesaba Range included, but it was Mr. Power's undaunted fighting spirit that won the battle. That Mr. Power's endeavors were thoroughly appreciated by the people of Hibbing was clearly shown by Thursday night's demonstration. The parade was one of the prettiest things of its kind ever held in the city. All the street lights were turned off, and everyone in the line of march was provided with varicolored lights. and those in connection with the automobile headlights presented a sight that will never be forgotten.
I'll just read this one because there's some different details.
Yeah, read that one.
Exultant ovation was paid Mayor V.L. Power last night by more than 1,000 citizens of Hibbing who greeted the mayor as he stepped off the 11 o'clock train following his triumph in defeating the Harrison tax limitation measure. Fireworks, torches, the fire department, and the city band were decided features in the celebration, which continued until early this morning. When the mayor had been placed in an automobile and was being taken uptown, the entire White Way was put out, and lights from torches in hands of motorists gave 3rd Avenue, for nearly a mile, the appearance of one huge fire, which made the avenue practically as light as day. So many automobiles, men, women, and children had assembled at the station that it took considerable time for cars to get straightened out for the parade. The parade extended many blocks. It was the purpose of the committee in charge to have Mayor Power give a speech at the armory, but the mayor begged to be excused. He said he was tired as he had traveled all day. He had not been home for 3 weeks, so the committee showed clemency and allowed his request. An informal celebration took place at the Elks Club after the parade. So he didn't quite go home. He went to the Elks Club. Throughout the parade and up to half an hour before the train came in, carnival spirit, rivaling that of the biggest 4th of July celebrations in the history of the village, was rife. Enthusiastic persons had devised noise-making contraptions, which they used with wonderful effect. Roman candles and even an occasional skyrocket were seen shooting heavenward. Torches burning in myriads of colors lighted the streets and were reflected from the sky like a huge blaze. Tooting of tin horns and automobile horns and sirens, the clang of the fire department as it dashed to the station, cheering of citizens and the pyrotechnic display of all combined to make the occasion distinctly unique in the history of the village. In view of the fact that Mayor Power did not speak last night, plans are underway for a monster banquet at the armory here to celebrate the defeat of the Harrison Bill, the campaign against which the mayor probably will explain. A committee has already been appointed to arrange for the banquet, which may be held sometime next week. This was supposed to be the Steel Corporation's comeback. Okay, you want to win your little city election in Hibbing, fine. We'll let you have Hibbing, but we're going to cap you. If Vic Power can leave Hibbing and still beat the Steel Corporation on foreign territory, so to speak, well, there's no limit to what he might be able to do. And the fact that he's a threat to the Steel Corporation becomes all the more obvious.
I have been waiting for 6 episodes to talk about this moment.
Yeah.
We can be done now. Sorry, guys. There's not going to be any more episodes.
No, just kidding. But the thing of it is, think about a small town of 10 or 15,000 people. What would get people to do that? Now or in the past or at any point in their history, there are a handful of things, the end of a war, the victory at maybe a state championship, but this even seems bigger than that. This seems otherworldly how much people were losing their minds. And it's because, I think, they knew that the Vic Power program was going to go forward. And that meant legit prosperity and prospects for all of these people who were out there cheering. They weren't just cheering for Vic. Vic had unlocked them from a system that had kept them in place, whether they were a miner or a business owner or any position in town. And Vic was saying, what you've got, you can get more. He was empowering the village. Only people free from prison can be that happy. And I think that's what it must have felt like.
I think you're right. Oh, what a story. I have like an adrenaline rush.
I know. Well, this story, I read it years and years ago because it was in the paper years and years ago on a nostalgia column. And this is the one back in the O's that got me into Vic Power's history.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, people don't even do this for the 4th of July anymore.
Yeah, man. Whew. So, probably needless to say, but the U.S. Steel Corporation didn't take this defeat too lightly.
Yeah, when they're stomping on your grave, when the whole town is burning torches, things have gone wrong.
So, the Lake Superior Tax Association decides, you know what, we're not going to pay our taxes anymore. Sue us. And the next fight begins. 1915 is just a series of blows, man. It's just like one punch after the next in Vic's face. And when you're reading this history, it's like 1915 is a boxing match. And you're just waiting for Vic to fall. And you're just baffled at how he keeps... He doesn't knock the minds out. He keeps pummeling them enough that the ref comes in and is like, okay, time out, you know? And then they keep coming back, and he keeps coming back, and they just keep pounding on each other.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't have much time after the defeating the Harrison bill before the mines announce that their next course of action is, you know, their doomsday option, which is we're not going to pay taxes. Which immediately, because mines pay 90% of the tax levy, means that the village is going to be without money. They're now saying, well, we just won't pay our taxes. Yeah, you'll have to sue us. We might lose, maybe, who knows. But meantime, you can't spend all this money and you can't employ all these workers. And we're going to regain control, because even if we're losing money on this, we're controlling the situation. And that's what faced the village council and Mayor Vic as they approached what was an unprecedented situation. We don't have any money. We're a village with no money.
Economic starvation, mm-hmm. A tool that the current U.S. government uses all over the world,
yeah,
in countries that don't obey their orders.
Sanctions. It is literally sanctions.
Yes. So I don't know the history of sanctions. I don't know where it started. I'm sure it goes back a long, long time. But what is the history of a corporation sanctioning a democratic organization of people?
There's not much like it. And think about it. Like, what if maybe you know somebody who doesn't like paying taxes and they want to protest? And so an individual says, I'm not going to pay my taxes. I hate the government. That works for a while. And then they arrest you.
Right. And that is kind of what's happening here. Vic knows that it's illegal. Vic knows that he's going to win in court. There's no clearer path to victory that he could take. Seems like an open and shut case, right? So what does Vic do? He goes to the city council and says, all right, if they're not going to give us money, let's make our own.
Yeah.
And he effectively creates his own currency. How ingenious is that?
It's a novel system using the system that the village already has, which is what they call warrants. In other words, IOUs. The village owes you this much money and will pay you this much interest if you can wait until we get the money in our bank account. And what that's normally used for is odd moments where there's a big bill due and they're waiting on the tax levy funds to come through. So they tell a contractor, for instance, hold this check. You know, it was an old system. But what they did is they used it for everything. They issued warrants to the city workers. They issued warrants to everybody who had business with the city. And they said, you know, it's this much money that we owe you plus 10% when you cash this in when we win this fight. And what happened, and it required everybody in town to go along with it, merchants in the village started using the warrants as cash. They would accept them as payment for groceries, gasoline, anything else that people needed. That meant that, well, for all practical purposes, everybody had money because the village was doing stopgap measures to keep everybody able to live their lives.
Quick aside, just a note on this. It's a big idea that we can really illustrate with this one moment. That currency is only given value if everyone wants to accept that it has value, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
US currency, Bitcoin, like all this stuff only has value because everyone's playing the game. And I guess it's not surprising because moments ago, 90% of the city was out in the streets burning torches in Vic's name. So it's not surprising that when he says to everyone, hey, trust me, if you guys use this as currency, it's going to be cool. You're going to get your money. Don't worry, I'll sort it out. And everyone says, okay.
Yeah. One of the more conservative banks refuses to take warrants, the First National. But Security State Bank, the one that has always been allied with the Power family, they agreed to use the warrants and accept them.
And Merchants and Miners, which is partially owned by the Power family.
Yeah, it was founded by Walter.
Yeah.
And other banks agreed to use the warrants. So really, by accepting the warrant, you as a citizen of Hibbing are saying, we believe Vic will win. We think Vic will win, and that's an investment, a good one, a short-term investment that turns 10% profit. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's really good.
And so actually, a lot of villagers wanted the warrants and would pay cash for them to get them because they felt that confident that Vic would get the mines to pay their taxes and that all those warrants would be paid back at with interest. And it was going to be a big payout for all the people who could gather and hoard those warrants. So it was a thrilling bit of financial maneuvering to use these warrants as cash in the village. And it really kept them in the game through the long months of legal action, because this was now going not where Vic just was, which is the legislature. Now he's going into the courts and he's making an argument in court in front of judges. There's another thing to think about. Your town has a legal problem and you have a huge, enormous court case that you would normally have to pay a lawyer to cover for you. The mayor will cover it himself, which is another remarkable fact of this situation. The mayor was also the head of the legal team.
Seems like an interesting precedent. I mean, you see that all the time now. Like, all of our politicians have legal degrees.
Well, it was common for lawyers to be involved in politics, but for a small town like this to have arguably the best trial lawyer in the state as their mayor, you know, he was the kind of lawyer that people paid top dollar for to win their cases, because he did win cases. He won. Oh, by the way, he's still practicing law during all of this. He's winning cases left and right for bootleggers and who knows else who needs to get out of a criminal rap. He's still doing all this. It's the undercurrent of the whole story is that his law office is always working, even during the thick of all this. But yeah, he'll take on the village case to court now. And he's got a great argument. What the mines are doing is slow walking it, trying to keep it as slow as possible so that the village starves and therefore has to play ball. They're both trying to get a negotiated solution that's to their advantage. And the question is, who blinks first? The issue here is time. Every day, every week that goes by, the merchants who are taking the warrants as cash have less cash. And if they owe money outside of town, or if they owe something else somewhere else, or they need to pay a supplier, they got to figure out a way to turn the Hibbing money into regular money.
Right.
It's getting tight for them. And make no mistake, as much faith as people had in Vic Power, they were rather desperate that summer of 1915. There wasn't any money around, and the people hurting most were the business people, who were not used to hurting that way. And they're sticking with Vic, but it's getting dicey. And Vic is digging in. I mean, the newspaper reports. Hold on here. I clipped this one.
Minneapolis?
Yeah, Minneapolis Tribune. This is during the tax fight, August of 1915. The man who is now so prominently before the public eye, referring to Vic, is a typical example of the success frequently attained in a mining country. A man of medium height, stocky in build, with a smooth, shaven face and aggressive air. He does not look like a quitter. Keep in mind, this is a message war. The mines say Hibbing has been spending extravagantly, whereas Vic Power says the mines are trying to crush Hibbing, or at least its government, to gain control of the land underneath it.
And not only is Vic Power saying that, the people of Hibbing are also saying that.
Well, they feel it.
And they're saying it very loudly.
Yeah.
They are, by and large, like, just an overwhelming majority is in support of Vic. And they feel the changes to their lives because of what Vic Power has done so far. So they look at what the mines are doing as an abuse of power. They're feeling abused by the mines, which is what is allowing Vic this time. But he's also not wasting any of it. I mean, he very aggressively starts going after that tax money. He sues the mines, and the Taxpayers Association brings him to court. And while he's doing that, he simultaneously goes to the state government and says, hey, these guys aren't paying their taxes, so that means you need to relinquish their leases, right? Help me out here, state.
Yeah, so Power appeals to the state auditor, a man named J.A.O. Price, who ends up becoming a significant figure in Minnesota history later on. But at the time, he's just the state auditor. And Vic Power wants him to cancel the state's mining leases. Now, the state owns a lot of land that they allow mining to take place upon that the state gets a royalty on, a small one. But it's important business, the state mining leases. It still is, actually, today. And so Vic is saying, hey, these mines aren't paying their taxes. Cancel their leases. We'll give them to somebody who will pay their taxes. In other words, some other company. It's really a dangerous territory for the mines, because if they lose their leases, they lose their whole industry. And so I like to point out that Vic is kind of credited with a great defense. He protects Hibbing during this time. But he sustains the defense by being very aggressive during this period. He may not get everything he tries to get. You know, we haven't even talked about the fact that he tried to divide the county back in that same legislative session.
Oh, that's a whole separate podcast.
It's a whole separate podcast. But he tried to make a northern county that local people could control and therefore put the mines in a tighter bind. He's trying to get them to pay their taxes. He'll take away their leases if they don't pay their taxes. He's taking them to court.
There's no stone unturned.
Yeah.
Victor Power was able to find every creative route to squeeze the mines he possibly could in this period.
Yeah. But he's also, like I said, fighting this message war. And I wanted to read just a quick quote from this Minneapolis Tribune article from August 1st of 1915, because we live in this time where there's like alternate facts, two realities, and political differences are often based on factual understanding being different.
You're talking about today.
Today.
2021.
In 2021, we feel that in our bones, in our politics. Well, it was true then, and a lot of times the ignorance was just because it was hard to know about a small town in northern Minnesota if all you had was a newspaper in Minneapolis. So Vic was going to the Twin Cities media, just like he is here, and actually presenting real facts about what was true in Hibbing. So this is what Vic says, quote, "Why all this opposition to Hibbing?" he asked. "Virginia levies a higher tax rate than does Hibbing, but the mining company pays the tax. Chisholm levies a higher rate than Hibbing, but the mining company pays the tax. Anyone who wants an answer to this anomaly can have it when he realizes that the Steel Corporation absolutely controls the expenditures in these towns, but does not control them in Hibbing. We might also ask why the steel company opposes the street and other improvements in Hibbing. The answer here also is plain. The entire town of Hibbing is underlaid with the richest iron ore in the world, and the steel company does not want improvements placed above this property which it purports or proposes to exploit later."
That's a bomb drop right there.
Yeah.
That's a huge bomb drop. That means that changes the whole game of understanding from what we knew about Vic Power up to discovering this quote, because he's using the city as leverage.
Yes.
He knows that the city's gonna have to relocate because of the iron-rich land underneath it.
What he's willing to do is make it clear to people that the mines are trying to starve out Hibbing so that Hibbing will quietly move or die off so that the mines can get at the ore. Whereas Vic has always known this and has wanted them
to pay for it.
To pay for it. So he's in the middle of 1915, years before moving happens. He knows that it's coming. And one of the accusations against Hibbing is that they're putting everybody on the payroll. Essentially, they're paying off the whole town to vote for Vic and to support him. And that's why all this money is going out the door. Vic's just handing it out to his political friends.
He's running an unemployment program is what he's running.
Yeah. Mining is not like other industries. It's not like factories. It's not like farming. It's just a different kind of business because, especially at this time, when the ground freezes in the winter, you can't mine soft material out of the earth. You might be able to go underground and do some mining, but on the pits that surround Hibbing, the open pits, you can't, at this time, work in the pits. So the mines lay off thousands of people every winter. Now, if this were now, those people will go down and file for unemployment, and they'd receive a portion of their pay for a period of time until the mines reopened, and then they get called back. People who work in construction nowadays are very familiar with this system. This is how it works. Well, this system doesn't exist back then. So Vic creates it in Hibbing, and it's local to Hibbing. He, because he's also building a lot of stuff, finds work that people can do in the winter. And he hires crews, if not everybody, then everybody who needs a job rotates and gets a little bit of money for working through the winter.
He's doing the mines a favor by doing this, because he's keeping the workforce in town.
Yeah, he's keeping the labor in town. And so here he's quoted saying in the same Tribune, Minneapolis Tribune article, "There is absolutely nothing to this story that we have had 1,100 men on the payroll at one time. The highest number we have ever had on the payroll at one time was 500, and that was done after a conference with the street company, which we agreed to keep their men busy during a slow period. During that time, the same men were employed for 2 or 3 days at a time and then let go, and others employed, and this revolving process was continued. And now the Steel Trust, ignoring this condition, charges us with employing a number of men we never thought of employing." He is saying that we kept these workers in work through the winter for the mining companies. And we know from reading contemporary histories of that time that it was life-changing for these people in the winter, in the Minnesota winters, to have money coming in that they could use to buy groceries and coal and to survive, because this was a life or death thing for people.
We need to change our paradigm about the mining company's money being the tax money. Like, it's tax money. Everyone pays the tax money. Just because the mines are paying the largest portion doesn't make it the mining company's money anymore. Because once it's taxed, it is now government money, and it's used to pay for programs that everyone can benefit from. I mean, that's the whole point of the taxation, right?
The other thing Vic is saying is that the reason they've had to spend so much on expenditures like the water pipes and the sewers and the streets and some of these infrastructure projects is because the mines have required them to move them. So the mines are getting something for their tax money too. So just because the mines pay the most taxes, they're also profiting from a system that allows them accessible labor, that allows them transportation to and from their mines of people and product. They're benefiting. So this is, if you think about it in more modern political terms, this is progressive politics in the true understanding of what a progressive tax is. Those who benefit the most pay the most. And he is applying it on a local level to the village of Hibbing. And only because U.S. Steel was such an unquestioned force, and only because Hibbing was so small and far away for most of the people reading about it, were the mines able to get away with saying that he was just spending, as one judge said, like a drunken sailor.
So, Vic goes to court. Vic wins.
Yeah.
I don't know that we need to detail it any further than that. There was a series of court cases.
Yeah.
Every time the judges ruled in Vic's favor, and after the final appeal was finished and Vic came away victorious, there was a settlement.
Right. It got a little tight in September and October because the cases had come down, but the mines still hadn't released the money. The village was choking along. Believe it or not, Vic convinced the police and fire departments to work without pay for 3 months with the promise that they'd get money with interest when the money came in. So that's the loyalty that he had, his police and fire department, which were quite large for a small town, stuck with him through that period. The danger, if the police and firefighters had gone off the job because of lack of pay, there was talk of the governor sending in the National Guard. And Vic was very concerned about this because the last time the National Guard had been sent in was on behalf of the mines. And the other thing that's happening, and this is a foreshadowing element as well, the mines are hiring their own police force. And the worry was that a private army essentially might be used to patrol the streets of Hibbing. And he felt that that was akin to a military occupation, and he didn't want any part of that.
But all this is kind of moot because it comes to a head now that the mines have lost a series of cases and they need to settle. So Vic and W.J. West, who is the superintendent for the Oliver Mining Company, who lives on the range, get together in a closed-door meeting in his office. And it is a dramatic event that grips the whole town.
So picture this, the day before Thanksgiving, the town, the mining company, both are desperate, and Victor Power meets with William West in his office, and meantime, in the council chamber at City Hall, it's like a wedding. You got the mining party on one side, and you got the village party on the other side, and they're waiting awkwardly, sternly, and there's all this tension. And if you can just imagine the tension involved with the two sides that kind of hate each other. And then there's Mac McEachin.
D.D. McEachin.
Victor's friend and...
probably a little drunk, because he mostly was.
It's very possible. And he's also a big guy.
And apparently getting fatter.
Just for perspective, D.D. McEachin is always just a little bigger than Vic as they get older. Vic's a pretty big guy, too. And at one point, a pearl button on the vest, and he's a men's clothier, so he's got nice stuff. The button pings off of his vest right in front of everybody.
The top button, and like bounces across the floor, and Mac, being maybe a little tipsy and a little bit of a jokester, puffs up his chest and pops the next button off.
And he says, they settle, they don't. They settle... they don't, just like the Daisy where he loves me, he loves me not. And
he's popping buttons off in sequence to break the tension in this room, and everyone, you know, starts laughing. It was apparently a big enough event that it got written about in the paper.
It definitely cooled the fire a little bit, and of course it helps a lot with what happens next.
And there's, at this point, there's hundreds of people. I think the paper said 800 people were
right.
collected in City Hall at this time.
They're lined up in the hallways. They're lined up the front door, down the steps. And of course, they're pooled around the outside of City Hall. And so it would have been a very, like imagine the Willy Wonka emerging from the factory, kind of like Vic and William West emerge from Vic's office and come the block and a half down the street to enter City Hall. And the excitement was palpable, especially when one of them mutters to Underling, we got a deal.
And let me just read for you from the Masaba Ore an overview of what happened that day. Today, Hibbing steps back into the position it has held for years as being the hub of the Masaba Range, and taking Tuesday's meeting as a barometer of the spirit of cooperation that exists here, Hibbing will advance by leaps and bounds to a greater and bigger city. The meeting was called to order by Mayor Victor L. Power, who received an ovation, and for 5 minutes the applause that greeted him was deafening. Mayor Power said in part, quote, "Interested as I am, always in the feeling of people in which office I hold by reason of their support, I come here this evening to settle the differences, to compromise, as it were, the trouble that exists between the mining companies and the village administration. While in office, I saw it fit to undertake a program of improvements, which is history to all of you. The disagreement that came up between the two parties is also fresh in your minds. Tonight, Mr. West and I disposed of the entire matter, and what has taken months to decide was settled in 1 hour."
We know from the tax fight that Vic Power was on to the fact that the town was going to have to move. And we know from years before Vic was even in office, the mines were talking about it behind closed doors or in subtle asides. And so this agreement brought to the end this great fight, and it brought it in as a clear victory for Victor Power. It looked like Vic got most of what he wanted, that the mines had to eat it a little bit. But the fact is, I don't think the mines would have agreed to that if there weren't some understanding that Vic was going to help them down the line with something that they needed. And the thing that everybody knew that they needed was a little bit of help when they had to move the town.
Power in the Wilderness is produced by Aaron Brown and Carl Jacob, and edited by me, Carl Jacob.
The show is made possible in part by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
If you'd like to hear past episodes of Power in the Wilderness,
or if you'd like to see pictures about the people and places we talk about, you're going to want to check out our website, powerinthewilderness.com. It's really cool.
We'll see you next time on Power in the Wilderness.